If you were with us last week, you know that we're in the book of Acts. We're looking at some information in Acts chapter 6. We kind of gave a tidbit of where we want to go today. This is a really important verse. In fact, as you look at the ASV, this verse is set off in a paragraph of its own. You have the seven fellows. We talked about them from Acts chapter 6, verses 4 and 5 last week. The apostles said we're going to continue steadfastly in prayer and the ministry of the word. The saying pleased the whole multitude. They chose seven men. We talked about those guys. And then we get down to verse 7, which is where we want to spend our time today. Plus, there's an article that I want to share with you. It ties in, I think, fairly well with the book of Acts and some of the things that we've looked at and some of the things that are down the road a bit. In Acts 6, 7, the text says, "And the word of God increased, and the number of the disciples multiplied in Jerusalem exceedingly, and a great company of the priests were obedient to the faith." We've seen different snapshots in the book of Acts as far as Christians, you know, becoming more and more numerate in the city of Jerusalem, and that's exactly what we have here. Luke describes this growth in three ways. Can you pick them out, the words that he uses? Three ways. Number one, they increased. That's way number one. Number two, they multiplied. And then number three, we have the word greatly. Some translations like the ESV may use a different word, something like exceedingly. So you have those three words. And not only do you have those three words, you would also want to, if you're looking at those words, think about the tense. You would expect with those three words, what kind of tense? Should be ongoing. Yeah, it is ongoing. So the imperfect tense is used. So you have three great words. You have continuous action expressed. So it's almost like you've seen perhaps pictures of fire. It just leaps from this building to that building, and it's just going and going and going. It seems like it's never going to stop. That's the picture of the growth. So it really was a magnificent time as far as the growth of the first century church. The apostles, they said that they wanted to spend more time or their time focusing on outreach, and that's exactly what they did. We know that the Jewish rulers were not always that receptive. We saw that some in Acts chapter 5. But as we look at Acts chapter 6 and verse 7, we find that there were some priests who were willing to listen. In fact, Luke says that how many priests were willing to listen and obey? He says there were a great number. Now, when I see that, the first thing that runs through my mind is how many? For us, a great number might be 100 or a couple hundred. Are we dealing with 1,000 or maybe several thousand? Carol?
Well, you know, when you talk about groups of people, you tend to generalize, and if there's a couple of bad apples, Christ, but in reality, usually the small percentage
right.
is the loud one. So that's what we think of them. But who should have better been prepared to accept Jesus than the priest?
Yeah.
Really? So there may have been more priests that followed him, whether it was quietly or not.
Yeah, the squeaky wheel gets the grease. And that principle needs to be applied to Scripture because you see these fellows, they're objecting. And you may get the impression that everybody rejected him, but there were, in certain circles, some people who were willing to be adhering to his teachings. When you look at that word verb, which is translated obedient, there are several things which are important about it. The first is the tense. Again, it is expressed with the imperfect tense. These priests were obedient. So it's almost like there is a steady stream of priests becoming Christians. And that is a magnificent, that is a very unusual picture. So you can imagine here were fellows who were serving as priests for the Levitical system, that Old Testament system, and they decide that they're going to abandon that system and they are steadily going to become Christians. One source said, "The imperfect of repetition and duration suggests the continuing nature of the conversions of those who paid heed to the preaching of the apostles and committed themselves to it, that is, who submitted heart and spirit to what they heard, the doctrine and requirements of the Christian faith." One quick point here. We hear people talk about faith. It's something to be accepted. The teachings need to be believed. But as you look at Acts 6, 7, what else do you find about faith? It also needs to be... Well, no, not only that. They were what to the faith? They were obedient to the faith. So when we talk about faith, it's not only something that you have mentally, but it's also something that is to be obeyed. And for a lot of people, they just never get that. That's almost a foreign concept to people. What do you mean, obedient to the faith? Well, we mean what is described in Acts chapter 6 and verse 7. I'll say more about that in a minute, but I do want to mention to you a couple things. there are some sources which indicate that just attached to the temple ministry in Jerusalem, you have about 8,000 priests. I don't think that was it. But just attached to the temple ministry in Jerusalem, you have about 8,000 priests. And as Carol mentioned, you do have some of those guys who have been high-profile priests, and they're the ones who are going to get the attention. Whether they obeyed or whether they didn't, those are the fellows that sort of stand out as representatives for the whole group. But you do have a lot of other fellows. Some of them might have been stone cutters. Some of them may have been involved with agriculture. Some of them may have sold oil. So you do have some more influential priests, but you also have some fellows who would be not so influential. But normally we think about the guys who are serving the scribes and judges and so forth. So again, we'll come back to the priests in just a bit. When you look at the word which is translated obey, that's an interesting word. It's used 21 times in the New Testament, and here are some ways and places in which it's used. It's used, for example, in Matthew chapter 8 and verse 27. Remember, the wind and the sea obeyed who? Jesus. They submitted to him. And that's a good illustration of what we have in Acts chapter 6 and verse 7. The unclean spirits, over in Mark chapter 1 and verse 27, they also obeyed Jesus. It is that same term. This is used in a slightly different way, but remember that maid at the door in Acts chapter 12 and verse 13, Rhoda, she listened at the door. So slightly different idea there. It's also used in Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 1. Children do what? Young people, you need to obey. Well, that same word is used here in Acts chapter 6 and verse 7, and that helps parents understand what that word means, and it can help kids understand what they need to do in relation to their parents. The term is also used in Colossians 3, verse 22, when Paul talks about slaves. If you were in that day and time, and you had a slave, you paid good money, hopefully you're treating your slave well, what would you want that slave to do? Obey. I mean, it's the same thing. You've hired somebody, you want that employee to obey what the work rules are and do the things that he or she is asked to do. You find it in 2 Thessalonians chapter 1, verse 8. Those who obey not the gospel, remember that word? Those who obey not the gospel are going to suffer eternal punishment. So if you want to go to heaven, what do you need to do? You need to obey. And that's what these priests are willing to do in Acts chapter 6 and verse 7. You also find the word being used in 2 Thessalonians 3, verse 14. Paul said some Christians do not obey God's plan, and that's a problem. Hebrews 5, verse 9, two more references here. Hebrews 5, verse 9. God is the author of eternal salvation to those who obey him. We've heard that word many times from Hebrews chapter 5 and verse 9. But here's the same word. And then in 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 6, you have Sarah obeying her husband Abraham. Now, when you think about a steady stream of priests becoming Christians, here you are. Again, we don't know whether or not the congregation in Jerusalem was all one group. Maybe they had split off. So there's just no telling exactly how that was set up. But when you start seeing a steady number of priests coming into your assemblies and you learn who these guys were, it's fairly typical, isn't it? Somebody starts coming to services, you ask, what's your name? Where do you live? Who are you? And maybe some of these guys were known. If you have Jews in your congregation, it may be, well, hey, weren't you that priest that, you know, I gave him animal sacrifice to? I remember you. You're the guy that, you know, is, you know, extra tall or extra short, whatever it might be. These fellows would have probably gotten a lot of attention just for that reason. But I think there's another reason as well. If you were a priest, you become a Christian. Now, if you're a stone cutter or you are a seller of oil, that may not be such a big deal. But if you're one of those priests that was working at the temple, what's going to happen to you economically?
You're done.
I mean, you can't go back to that job. They're not going to want you if you're a Christian, and you're not going to want that because you're going to be now involved with what is a false religion. So when you think about some of these guys, it is at least probable, if not, I think, absolutely right to say that they probably had to go through a career change. Now again, for some of the other priests that were involved with some of these daily activities, they probably could have done okay. But for some of the other guys, maybe closely attached to the temple, they'd have to give up their job. A couple points from that. You remember that sermon a couple weeks ago on Sunday morning? Jesus said, gouge out your right eye. Do what with your right hand? Cut it off if you want to go where?
Heaven.
If you want to be a member of the church, and ultimately heaven's going to be your home, you may have to make some great sacrifices for the cause of Christ. Sometimes people need to make a career change for the cause of Christ. In spite of that, do we hear some people sometimes today saying, well, that would be too hard. I couldn't give up him or her, or I couldn't give up that, I couldn't give up my job. Ever hear anybody make that kind of argument?
Yeah.
It would just be too difficult. Well, now, wait a minute. What'd these guys do? So, when people come and they say, well, you know, I just could never... Well, let's go back and look at Acts chapter 6 and verse 7. Anything that you want to add or ask before we say a little bit more? Okay. One other quick point. Jesus, remember what he said? Take up my cross, how often? Daily. And follow me. That's exactly what these guys did. Now, when you look at Acts 6, 7, depending on your translation, do you have a word before faith? A great company of the priests were obedient to not just faith, but the faith. Now, if you're reading that on your own, what might you think? Or what hopefully would you think? Yeah, this is not just faith in the sense of I believe, but this is the faith in the sense of, yeah, the gospel, God's plan. How to become a Christian, how to live as a Christian, how to worship, everything associated with Christianity. Now, you do find several times in the New Testament this expression, not just faith, but the faith. There is a definite article in the Greek text, and we'll look at two or three of these references. Acts 14:22 is one place. We'll also look at 1 Timothy 4:1 and Jude 3. Acts 14:22. Who wants to? All right, Steve. And then we'll look at 1 Timothy 4:1. Don. And then we'll take a look at Jude 3. Third verse in Jude. Who wants to take that one? All right, Steve. Thank you. Let's go back to Acts chapter 14, verse 22.
Strengthening the souls of the disciples, exhorting them to continue in the faith, and saying, we must, through many tribulations, enter the kingdom of God.
Okay, would you say that there's a difference in exhorting people to continue in faith and exhorting people to continue in the faith? Exhorting, encouraging you to continue in faith would mean what? Yeah, just, you know, believe and kind of continue on. But if I tell you to, you need to stay in the faith, what am I saying? You do things according to God's plan. You do not deviate from what he said. And that's what they were exhorted to do. Then you have, Don, 1 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 1.
But the Spirit explicitly says, in later times, some will fall away from the faith, paying attention to deceitful spirits and doctrines of demons.
Okay. Some will not just fall away from faith. They still might believe, but what are they going to depart from? They're going to abandon the faith, the system, the Christian plan that God has given. And then we're probably familiar with Jude 3. Let's take a reference. Let's have that one read by you, Steve.
Beloved, while I was very diligent to write you concerning our common salvation, I found it necessary to write to you, exhorting you to contend earnestly for the faith, which was once for all delivered to the saints.
Okay, 2 points from that. Number one, he says, the faith. What's true about it? It was delivered once. The sense there is once for all time, never to be repeated again. God has given that body of truth, and that came in the first century. It was given to the apostles. And then he said, you have this information delivered to you. What do you need to do with it? Contend for it, strive for it, put a lot of energy into it. Why? Because it's going to be what leads you to the right heavenly home. You don't want to go any other direction, otherwise you'll be lost. Anything that you want to ask before we make a couple of the quick points? Okay? When you think about the number of priests who were converted, let's think about that in a little more detail. We know that we have a great company of the word, the great company of priests. There was a big crowd. But he also, as we said, we can extract some numbers. I mentioned to you the 8,000. You also, if you were to go back to the book of Ezra, Ezra chapter 2, and look at verses 36 through 39, you could do some math there. And you would find that, and this is in relation to the Babylonian captivity, when God's people came back from Babylonian captivity, they had 4,289 priests. Now let's think about this for a little bit. Babylonian captivity, 537 BC, so about 500 years before Christ comes into the world. You're locked up. What do you think is going to happen to your priesthood as you're locked up? All right, I think that's probably going to be the conclusion that most people would draw. It's going to be diminished because you're not able to go out and do the things that you would normally do. So you've got 4,200 plus priests, 500 years before Christ. The people come out of captivity. They're able to go back to Jerusalem. Things are set up again. Now you have 500 years, so what do you suspect that's going to happen in those five centuries? you expect that the priesthood is probably going to increase. That is what Josephus says. If you go back and you look at one of his accounts, he indicates that there were more than 20,000 priests in that day and time. Now, I don't think that's too big of a stretch. So he's not always completely reliable, but that is his estimate. So if you take all that information together, we have a great number, a great company of the priests. They were obedient to the faith. The imperfect tense, around 8,000 attached just to the temple. Some of these other guys were stonecutters, sellers of oil and things. Josephus says 20,000. That might allow you how many priests as far as the number becoming Christians? A great company in perfect tense. I think we're past dozens. Hundreds would certainly fit. Do you think we could be in the thousands? I think so. You may have 2,000, 3,000, 5,000, maybe 10,000 fellows who had served as priests. That would be a lot of folks. Can you imagine what the Jews, as far as the leaders, would have been thinking? If you lose some of the fellows who are sort of the outliers, the guys who are the stonecutters, and you know they're not that influential, maybe that's not such a big thing. But when you start cutting into the Jewish system, where you now have maybe a few thousand priests that have gotten axed, you think that's going to get the attention of the fellows who have the power? They're going to start noticing. And you can again see a basis for why we get over to Acts chapter 8, and you're going to find that there's this great persecution that finally culminates. So part of that persecution may be based on some of the priests. You've got Stephen's speech, and that certainly stirs things up in Acts chapter 7. But also what you're reading about here, that may help account for what we find a little bit later. Carol, did you have a thought? Somebody, I thought, did. Well, you lost the records when Jerusalem was besieged by the Romans in 70 AD. So they tried to kind of reconstruct things, but that's impossible.
Do we have any people acting as Jewish priests?
I believe that there are some that would take on that role. I remember over the years I've met a couple people who said, well, I'm of the tribe of so-and-so, and they affirm that with great certainty. Now, when somebody is so certain about that, you probably are not going to get very far by challenging. Well, how do you know? Well, and that's where things kind of start to fall apart. But, people, that's going to kind of tie in with what I'm talking about later as far as the article. So there's an indirect parallel, but people can claim anything they want. So you might find that some people do claim that they are priests. And for that religion to do what it needs to do, they would have to have some. Anybody else want to include a thought, ask a question?
You mentioned Stephen. Do you think the priests
I think all of this is just churning. You have the apostles being called before the Sanhedrin. They're threatened. That doesn't shut them down. There's a beating. That doesn't shut them down. You have all these people becoming priests, or all these Jews becoming priests. And, that doesn't seem to faze them. You've got all the miracles that are taking place. That stirs things up a little bit more. And now you've got all these priests being converted. And then you've got this speech in Acts chapter 7 before the Sanhedrin. And that's really outrageous. Stephen goes back and recites this Old Testament history. And, Gamaliel has tried to calm him down a little bit, and he's had some success. But it's almost beyond comprehension for me that they were this calm for this long. Because it's like you're just poking them in the stick time after time after time after time, and eventually they blow up. So it's not surprising when you look at Acts chapter 8, the first four verses, that there was this great persecution because the Jews had finally had enough. But remember too, and this is where you see God's timing, they kick them out of town, so to speak, but the church has grown to the point where now it's like spreading out a giant ant colony. And they can go out and create congregations here, there, and everywhere. So they've really lost the battle. And maybe Satan thought that at various times he was going to be successful. Look what we've done here. Look what we've done here. But ultimately, everything that he tried backfired. But yes, I do think that you want to include this. Anybody else? Okay, let's turn the page a little bit and see if we can make some application here. When you think about these priests becoming Christians, they're introduced to the gospel, they become Christians. Can you see a modern parallel of that? Parallel. something which would be similar.
To the priest becoming?
Yes. Oh, I thought it would be more obvious than that.
Sometimes you have, like, Muslims becoming.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. Maybe I didn't phrase my question well. What about denominational preachers? That was the question that I was really trying to get framed and hopefully get an answer to. You do find that. Sometimes in this country, probably more occasions, it's going to be outside this country. But there are fellows who are introduced to New Testament Christianity, and they look at what they were doing, and they say, this is not the right way to serve God, so we need to leave that way, and we need to go this way. Now, that's commendable for somebody who does that. In a foreign country, it may not be as big a deal as here. But when you look at here, this country, why is that often a problem? Even if a person is convinced that they're headed the wrong way spiritually, there have been some cases that I've read about. I don't know that I've seen it firsthand as far as somebody saying this, but here's a person who says, well, I think that's right. Your theology, your understanding of the Bible is correct. This would be the correct way for me to go, but I'm not going to do it. For what reasons? Well, okay. He says, I'm going to loop it up. But somebody says, well, why don't you go ahead and preach for a congregation that's tied in with New Testament Christianity? Trace? Well, good job. He just started to rate them all. It could create some problems within his family or friends, social circles. There might be some changes there. We don't have within the church any kind of retirement program. But if you were to jump ship and you went out and started to preach for a big name denomination, you think that you might have a retirement package?
Yes.
I mean, just like the post office. Not to pick on you, Gary, but you know, you are tied in with the system long enough, and here's what you get. Here's your 401k, and I have known of some guys who would not leave, or in some cases, they left the church because they were looking at the end result as far as their retirement on earth. And they said, well, this will give me a better end result. Well, temporarily it might, but not eternally. And then there have been some people, sadly, who have said, well, if I did that, I just, you know, would lose a status, and that falls back into the area of pride. And that's so sad. But there have been some people who have said, I need to stop what I'm doing and head over here. And I can think of one man specifically who was involved with Pentecostalism. He left it. Now, I don't think he probably left behind. He was preaching for a small country church. There was no retirement package. There was probably no pride to speak of that was an issue. So it may have been easier for him than some others, but that has come up. And some people have said, no, I will not change for all the reasons that Teresa listed. Any thoughts on that, or somebody else want to make a point? Teresa? Yep. Yeah, there have been a lot of things that people have done for money. Sometimes that happens with preaching. There have been some guys who have started with smaller congregations and have said, well, they haven't said it at least at the time, but it's kind of a stepping stone. I will start here, sort of an entry-level job, just as a person might start at McDonald's and they, you know, get a little experience under the belt and then they want to, or we've seen it in this area with factories. Person starts out with a factory and they get some experience and they say, well, this was good. Mike is saying no. But that does work out for some people. Sometimes you start out this factory and you think, well, that's great, and now I can move over here. They pay more, better benefits, better wages, and they just continue to hop through the ranks. So there have been some preachers who have done that throughout the years. So that's kind of a different class and a different discussion, but there have been some fellows who have done that. All right, a couple things that I will mention before we go back and look at the information that I have as far as a handout, and then we'll say more about that as we get to it. It's been asked why these priests seem to have been converted with very little effort, or why so many were willing to become Christians. I think there's some answers to that in the text and applied. Going back to Acts chapter 6, verse 7, and what? The word of God did what? Increased. What do we know about the power? For I'm not ashamed of the gospel, for it, the word, is the power of God unto salvation, Romans chapter 1, verse 16. The word certainly should have cut some weight with these priests, and it was being preached as it was being taught. That was one of the things that must have helped. We also have what in conjunction with the word. Don't have that now because the word's been completed. But while that word was yet in an incomplete state, what existed with it? Signs, miracles, a variety of gifts. And as the priest saw those things, you would hope that if you're a priest, you're going to be intellectually honest. And as they saw those signs to confirm the word, Mark 16 and verse 20, they must have had a great impact. Another item must have been the symbolism of the Old Testament. We've talked about this over the last couple of years, more than we have in several preceding years. But when you think about noblemen like Zechariah, that would be over in Luke chapter 1, verses 5 through 6, they were fellows who were able to look back. They were familiar with the Levitical system, and they, as that preaching was done, they could start to see, well, hey, this is what we've been doing for years, and this is what we've talked about, and this is what we've been taught. And now these guys are showing up with signs and preaching, and they're connecting all this stuff to the Old Testament. And that makes perfect sense to us. Maybe we couldn't understand it, why it was being done or God's purpose for it, but now all of a sudden everything is falling into place. So these fellows must have been ripe candidates for the gospel. One source said the imagery of the temple was designed to be God, designed by God to be preparatory to the coming of the Lord and the implementation of the Christian system. Carefully read Hebrews 9, verse 1 and following, and observe the detailed description of the tabernacle arrangement that was a prototype for the temple and the ordinances. They constituted a figure for the present time. The Mosaic Law was a schoolmaster whose function it was to bring the Hebrews to Christ, and through them, all others. You have, I think, two. Let's take a look at this. Matthew chapter 27, 62 to 66. In the closing verses, now I know Matthew has 28 chapters, but as you look at the closing verses in Matthew, in that 27th chapter, you're really at the end of the book, you have some information too, which may have helped bring these priests to Christ. Matthew 27, let's start with 62 and go down to 66. Who's got it? All right, Gary? 27, 62 to 66.
Now the next day that followed the day of the preparation, the chief priests and Pharisees came together unto Pilate, saying, Sir, we remember that the deceiver said, whilst he was yet alive, after 3 days I will rise again. Command therefore that the sepulcher be made sure until the third day, lest his disciples come by night and steal him away, and say unto the people, He is risen from the dead. So the last error shall be worse than the first. Pilate said unto them, Ye have a watch. Go your way, make it as sure as you can. So they went and made the sepulcher sure, sealing the stone and setting a watch.
Okay. If you are a police officer, and maybe you're not involved in this particular command, do you think word is going to kind of seep out to some other commands when a big deal comes up? People in the same profession seem to get word. So here you have the chief priests involved with the tomb of Christ. I suspect that there was some seepage there. And the ordinary priests also got that information. And now there have been some claims about Jesus being raised from the dead. Do you think that there were probably some times that people still went out and searched for the body? I think that there probably were some times. Now, a lot of time has passed. The body hasn't shown up. You have all these other things. And with the preaching that was being done, Acts chapter 6 and verse 7, the people thought, yes, this is the truth, the symbolism, everything fits, so we are going to become Christians. Then, if all this wasn't enough, if you were a priest, and we've talked before about the fact that at a certain age, the priests stepped back and they were no longer going to do the physical work that they had done up until that time. If you were a priest, do you think that you might have looked at your job as being burdensome? You know, all these rules, all these rituals, and I mean, you love God, you love the people, and you wanted to help them out, but still, it's like, wow, are you kidding me? And there's this preacher that shows up with this message which says God has a new system. And what's true concerning the burden? Burdens have been lifted at Calvary. We sing that song. And that might have been a good song for the priests had it been written way back when. And they must have thought, wow, this is great news. Now I'm going to have a job change. Well, that's going to be a big thing for some of them. But there were a number of reasons why, I think, as you look at Acts 6, verse 7, that this really was attractive to many of the priests. Anything that went at or asked before we switch to an article? Okay. This is, as I said, somewhat related to what we've talked about. It's also going to be relevant to some of the material that we're looking at. The title is The Prophets and Apostles Leading the Quiet Revolution in American Religion. So this is, we might not see as much of this in our area as we would, as maybe we would in California or New York, but this is a big thing right now. And if you want a copy of the article, I can probably copy some. If you don't have email, if you have email, I'd be glad to shoot you a copy that way as well. Subtitle is A Christian Movement Characterized by Multi-Level Marketing, Pentecostal Signs and Wonders, and Post-Millennial Optimism. Now that's a mouthful, but this tells you, it helps explain where the world is. He says, a quiet revolution is taking place in American religion. The rise of network Christianity, how independent leaders are changing the religious landscape. Largely behind the scenes, a group of mostly self-proclaimed apostles. Now get that. We are living in a time where there are some people who are running around. They're calling themselves apostles, but they are self-proclaimed apostles. Now, Carol, this goes back to what I was mentioning earlier as far as a priest. Anybody can run around and say, well, I'm a priest, I'm from the tribe of so-and-so. Just because they say something, that doesn't make it true. But now you have this from a Christian perspective. A lot of people are saying, we are an apostle. They're leading ministries from North Carolina to Southern California. We obviously would be included in that territory. And this movement has attracted millions of followers with promises of direct access to God through signs and wonders. Now think about that in terms of what we just described. One of the appeals of Christianity was, what's your access to God now? It's direct. And that was very, very meaningful to the people. Before, you had to go through the priest. Now that's been erased, that's been done away with. You can go directly to God. And now people are trying to market that same idea, but there's a much different perspective. The movement, which is called INC, and I'll give you the meaning of that, the Independent Network Charismatic. So just try to put that in your head. The Independent Network Charismatic, INC, has become one of the fastest growing faith groups in the U.S. Now, I don't know if that's tied into what we had. Ray was probably as exposed to that as I was. What we had with the Amish and all that stuff, the Pentecostal stuff about a year ago. I'm not sure if that was tied in with it or not. I'm wondering if maybe it wasn't. But anyway, it's become one of the fastest growing groups in the U.S. He says apostles like, now listen carefully, apostles like Bill Johnson, Mike Bickle, Cindy Jacobs, Chuck Pierce, and Che Allen claim millions of followers. Anything stand out to you in that sentence?
It's the last one.
Cindy.
Yeah, Gary got it. Che Allen. But yes, now you have female apostles in this group. So that sounds pretty inclusive, doesn't it? In this world that we live in, where people want to make sure that males and females are, you know, perfectly equal and we erase gender identity, you have now some ladies running around claiming that they are apostles of Christ. Then he goes on to say they're also aided by an army of fellow ministers who fall under their spiritual covering. So if somebody this week or soon talks about their spiritual covering, think back to today's class. Many of these people run mega churches, including, and he gives several, some of them from California. There's the International House of Prayer. To me, it looks like the International House of Pancakes in Kansas City, but that's just me. But the real power lies in their innovative approach to selling faith. They've combined multi-level marketing, Pentecostal signs and wonders, and post-millennial optimism to connect directly with millions of spiritual customers. That allows them to reap millions in donations, conference fees, and book and DVD sales. And because these INC apostles claim to get direct information straight from God, they operate with almost no oversight. We were talking, going back to Teresa's point, remember, sometimes follow the money. That's what they do when they're doing an investigation, and these religious sharks and hucksters, oftentimes it's the same thing. He says Nashville-based religion writer Bill Cementa spoke with a professor of sociology at a university and got some information, and I'm going to share this with you. He asked, what's the difference between INC Christians and the prosperity gospel movement or mega church networks from groups like the Association of Related Churches? The answer is probably the closest kinship would be prosperity gospel movement. But it's a little different in that the INC network cooperates more often. My sense of the prosperity gospel is that it consists of individual entrepreneurs, TV preachers, and mega church leaders. But there's not much cooperation. So that's kind of how it was in the past. Not so much. This guy has his program, this guy has his program, and maybe they get together, but for the most part, everybody's out on their own. Also, there's a difference in theology. The prosperity gospel would focus more on the individual's health and wealth. This group is unique in that they think God has really put apostles on earth to basically transform the world. Now, think about that. They think that God has put these people throughout the world, especially in the U.S., to transform the world. And they go on to say it's sort of a trickle-down Christianity where the apostles are at the top of the mountain exercising this power from top down. That's how the kingdom of God comes in. Ironically, this group isn't really focused on building up big congregations. Their ideas are spreading through other means like high-profile conferences and media products are selling. So if you follow the news, you've probably seen some conferences. We get some advertisements about this kind of stuff. You may see it as far as Facebook, some of the advertisements there. He goes on to say these apostles are able to access a lot more money because they're operating a pay-for-service model. Now, we've seen pay-for-service in a lot of different areas of life, but pay-for-service in religion is, I think, a fairly new concept for a lot of people. Now, it's old if you go back and you look at maybe the first century, some of the pagan religions as far as you pay us and we'll do this and that and the other thing. But now we're getting into a pay-for-service model rather than relying on people's donations and their goodwill. Congregations bend over backwards to keep people happy and to keep bottoms in the seats. People don't have to pay unless they feel like it. But this is a completely different financial model, and it tends to generate more money. He asks, how do the people in this group identify themselves? Are they Pentecostals, Charismatics, INC Christians? They would use the word prophetic or apostolic, or they would align themselves with one of the apostles. Now get this too. They would say, I'm a follower of Bill Johnson, or Bill Bickle, or Cindy Jacobs. People would say, he's my apostle, or he's my prophet. That sound like anything we find about in the Bible? 1 Corinthians chapter 1. I'm of Paul, I'm of Peter, I'm of Cephas. So they're going back to that kind of mentality. He said the other term we hear a lot is spiritual covering. And that's something that you might take away from the class as well. When they're talking about this kind of stuff, if you hear somebody say, he's my apostle, he's my prophet, or this person is my spiritual covering. There's this idea that you're under spiritual covering of your specific apostle or prophet. A related term is impartation. The apostles basically impart their power to you. If you're under them, the power that they have straight from God trickles down to you. Now, do you find any of that offensive? Let me go back and read this part again. Spiritual covering. You are under their spiritual covering. Any problem with that? Who's our spiritual covering? Christ. It's no man. It's no woman. It's no made-up apostle. But like I say, people are really into this stuff. Dick Carroll, do you have a thought? This is an example of that. Itching ears, and they've got it, and these guys are filling them up full. They consciously avoid any kind of formal organization or denomination. They see the strength of weak ties. It allows them room to, get this, experiment and work with all kinds of different people. Remember what we talked about earlier? The priests were obedient to what? The faith. Remember? It was not an experiment. It was not, let's try this in Jerusalem and see if it works, and we'll have a test market over here. But these guys have abandoned that concept. They can focus on putting together these big events. They don't have a support staff or donate to a seminary. They can just go straight to the marketing activities. Then he asked this question, how do you become an apostle? What's the process? I was just dying to get to that question. He says, it's all sort of self-appointed. Leaders in the moment would say that people are recognized as apostles because of the influence they have. Not only are you over your own congregation, but over other leaders. But there's definitely a good deal of self-appointing going on. Peter Wagner, a leader in the New Apostolic Reformation movement, referred to himself as a super apostle. Now, isn't that rich? So you just decide that you're going to be an apostle one day, and then one fellow comes along and he decides to designate himself as a super apostle because he was influential with a bunch of other apostles. It's easy to see the advantage for leaders. It's great to be the guy at the top of the pyramid since they get all the cash and no one tells them what to do. But it also seems like lay people really like this model. What do they get out of it? For the young people, they're searching for meaning. They're searching for adventure and excitement. Well, there again, you have your opportunity to experiment, and if this isn't jazzing things up, then you go ahead and change things up a bit. The kinds of churches which appeal to them, as far as the traditional congregations, they're just not working as far as the traditional churches. They're not merely trying to learn how to know God, how to live a godly life, or share their faith with others. They believe that they're really participating in this cosmic spiritual battle to transform the world. They're involved in this battle for whole cities and nations. Now, can you see how that would sell to people? You can be involved with a spiritual battle. You can become an apostle and just come and be part of our group, get our DVDs and sign up for our program, and we'll help you out. And then you have the appeal of direct access to God, getting direct downloads from God. God's going to talk to me and tell me what to do. Or my leader is getting direct downloads. For many people, that's more exciting than a 45-minute sermon examining the Greek terms from Paul's writings. Now, that'll sell, won't it? You can get your direct download from God. Let me tell you how. So they've taken multi-level marketing to a brand new level when it comes to religion. He says this doesn't have the same priesthood of all believers theology as some of the teachings in the past. That's a problem too, isn't it? Every Christian is a priest, but they throw that out. And they have to throw that out. Why? Because if all are priests, if all are on the same level, then what happens to your apostles and your super apostles? Can't have them. Since they're not building institutions, there's a lot of freedom for people to experiment with the tools they get from these apostles. So that opens up a lot of opportunities for people to lead, innovate, and create their own way of doing Christianity. Once again, that flies in the face of Acts 6, verse 7. There is the faith, and these fellows say, no, there's not. You just do what you want. Let's go on to the next page. He says, rather than traditional worship experiences and services, they have experiences. And then he says, what type of experiences are they trying to create? The traditional megachurch uses music and exciting preaching from great communicators. But we found that wasn't the case with these INC groups. They're actually not very exciting preachers. Now, that's one of the statements that struck me. But they don't have to be exciting preachers. Why? Because they're selling what? Not preaching, not teaching, but power, experience. We're going to directly hook you up with God. He says, first, for them, it's all about encountering these supernatural manifestations. It's very spontaneous. We went to a conference where a number of apostles were speaking, and Bill Johnson was doing a Bible teaching. He probably talked for 20 or 30 minutes, and you could feel the restlessness in the room. He said, I know you're just waiting for me to stop preaching because you want the power. Hang in there. People were not there to listen to him. What they wanted for was to lay hands on him. So again, there's back to, you have this promise and all of these great ideas, but they don't come to fruition. After he finished, people came up to the stage. They were being slain in the spirit. People were falling down, getting healed. The same kind of stuff that we've talked about before. That's what they're for. That's what they're there for. They don't want to sit in the pews and watch other people. They want to access the power themselves to make a difference in the world. He says the desire for this kind of experience is broader than just this group. It works out in interesting ways among these so-called Christians, but we see it across different religious groups that we've studied at this particular place. He said it's remarkable how effectively INC personalities can get their message out without owning a television studio or buying airtime. How do they manage that? He says they've managed to leverage digital technology, smartphones in particular, where you can get everything that you want as long as you have some kind of digital connection. It's also basically free to put your product out there. IHOP in particular is great at that. They say on their website, as far as viewed video content, it's one of the top 50 websites in the world. Now think about that. False religion, like I'm describing, is one of the top 50 websites in the world. So again, this isn't something that's a freak activity on the coast. This is something that's coming and growing big time. Between the internet and the conferences, they figured out ways to leverage that big, exhilarating, hyped-up experience you get at a stadium venue. That's where their networking comes into play. They can bring in four or five apostles, and their followers flock to see them. People have these significant experiences that juice them up to contact the apostles over the internet. If they can hit a conference two or three times a year, they get a new jolt. That becomes a new rhythm, as opposed to the weekly rhythm of church life. And then he talks about, anybody ever hear the Seven Mountains theology? Okay, you can read about that online, but basically there are some people who think that God is raising up certain leaders in our country, and they're going to be the seven mountains that you can read about in the Bible, and that God's going to do great things. They would look at Rick Perry and some of the other people in Trump's cabinet. I don't have time to get through all this, but Ben Carson, some other people like that. Now, Carson and Trump, they probably don't believe that theology, but the people who are these apostles, they will try to take these guys and try to tie them into